You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm your host, Michael McFaul, the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. We hear a lot these days about countries as threats to international security, whether it's North Korea developing nuclear weapons or Russia launching cyber attacks to disrupt Western democracies. But there's one major threat that knows no borders: bugs, the ones with the potential to kill millions of people regardless of nationality. Scientists have long said the world is overdue for a pandemic and that the risks of one occurring are rising fast. The reasons are both fascinating and frightening. Here to talk about the dangers posed by biological agents and the steps they are taking to help counter them are David Relman, the Thomas C. and John M. Merrigan Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford School of Medicine, and a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute, and Megan Palmer, a senior research scholar at FSI's Center for International Security and Cooperation. Thank you both for joining us today. You must get this all the time, the scary topics we have to talk about that we don't, but we are going to dig in and we're going to try to help our listeners understand about these threats. But let's start with some definitions so we kind of level set. You both work in biosecurity, which is a term that increasingly refers to much more than outbreaks of Ebola or influenza. What does biosecurity actually mean? David, I guess we're going to start with you.
Well, I'm happy to offer my thought about what it means to me, although I'll say that many people have different ideas of this term. To me, it means the efforts that we take to prevent harm from biological agents.
Just that simple.
I think so.
I thought you were going to give us a whole paragraph.
So.
Okay. Yeah, wow. Well, that's, there shouldn't be a dispute about that. Let's tease out a little bit. So some of it is caused in nature and some can be done deliberately by governments, by states. We should distinguish between those two different kinds of threats, correct? Or actually, I shouldn't assume I know that to be true, but maybe the kinds of things you need to protect one's personal security and national security are the same, irrespective of where the threat comes from.
Right. And that's a really interesting topic that's captivated many. The reason I gave such a simple definition, perhaps imperfect, but a simple one, is because I think it's important for it to be broad enough to cover a whole number of different scenarios. And those scenarios include just the ones you mentioned: naturally occurring outbreaks of disease,
right?
Deliberate events, efforts, events of deliberate origin, and also accidents that might be inadvertent or unanticipated.
That's a good point. And accidents is on the list as well, right?
And all three of those things might involve a whole variety of different agents, but I think that it's important to think about those different scenarios when we think about the kinds of problems and challenges that we face in trying to counteract.
So, Megan, of all the threats to international security, nuclear weapons, cyber attacks, soldiers, biological disasters and biological weapons don't seem to be on the newspapers front and center. Is that just because we're asleep at the wheel, or is it because these set of threats are actually better contained than the list I just talked about?
I definitely do not think it is because these threats are better contained.
Okay. All right.
And
tell
I think in
not.
Part, it's because these threats are persistent, especially when we're dealing with naturally emerging infectious disease, other types of biological threats that are with us all the time. We can often forget about the threat that they pose to our own security all the time. The threat of even seasonal influenza, right, is large and kills many, many people, every year. And that's one of the reasons it's important to think about these types of biological threats within a larger umbrella.
Well, let's talk about the possible consequences. Give us some parameters of other periods in history where there were massive loss of life. To help people understand these things that you worry about a lot, we maybe haven't had them recently, but they are world-changing events in the past, correct?
Right, right.
Well, in fact, I know it is correct because I've heard you speak about it before. So tell our listeners, David.
Well, there are some very well-known infectious agents which throughout human history have accounted for it is estimated hundreds of millions of deaths and far more suffering and disruption of society. Smallpox, for example, is thought to have accounted for many hundreds of millions of deaths, probably the most of any infectious agent in human history. Plague, likewise, changed the face of both the West and the East periodically through the last millennium. And even in this last century, you have the Spanish flu, 1918. Right. In fact, this is the 100-year anniversary of that event. It's estimated at least 20 or 30 million deaths, probably many more, in a world that was much smaller, leading us to think that were that to happen today, you're talking about many more people than that. And again, not even counting the kind of disruptive effect of a massive loss of life, the disability of people who are running our society, and the breakdown of just basic infrastructure.
Right. So there are economic and there are secondary and tertiary effects as well. Is that right?
Exactly. Very much. When we talk about man-made threats today, we are not only speaking about the types of advances in sort of biological science technology that may be applied to this space, but also the activities of our modern society that can aggravate and accelerate the types of threats of the past. And so there are many sort of different contributing factors that are leading to a problem that we are inevitably going to see in our society and facing the next pandemic threat.
And why do you use the adverb inevitably? Because it just is cyclical and it's going to happen for sure and we're not going to be prepared?
I think we are getting better and better every year at preparing for known threats. But every year we are faced with new types of diseases that we have to mount a response for, and these are only becoming more and more prevalent. And so the scale of the threat, the complexity of the threat is increasing all the time. And so, yes, it is inevitable that we will be dealing with the next sort of biological threat and the one after that. It is just a matter of how well we can prepare our defenses.
When you think about the forces that lie behind these periodic and some would say increasingly frequent natural events, those forces are things that you have to believe are only worsening. Climate change.
So climate change is a direct causal factor.
Absolutely.
Here?
As is.
Help us understand the science behind that.
So climate change has caused massive shifts in populations of small animals and insects, which serve as the reservoirs and the vectors for a lot of these infectious diseases. Climate change is also responsible for displacement of people, crowding of people. And those are important causes in and of themselves. Urbanization, the way in which we're changing the face of the landscape, deforestation, movement of people into parts of the world where there were agents all along that just didn't have a chance to infect people. Now they do.
Because the climate has changed.
Because the climate has changed, and we have had to change our behavior and response accordingly.
Are we getting smarter about anticipating new diseases, new threats because of technological advances? Or is that something that is hard to know in advance?
I think probably both.
Okay.
You know, we are developing a number of new strategies to be able to monitor the types of threats that are emerging. And to be able to understand new strategies to counter those. But at the same time, we are dealing with really a number of new types of threats that may emerge from recombination of existing diseases through such sort of zoonotic reservoirs. And also the
zoonotic
ability.
Zoonotic. Yeah. Help me understand that adjective.
This is exactly what David was referring to, the sort of interaction between different types of animal species and humans, and how that crossing over and increasing contact can often lead to new diseases that emerge in human populations, and often those are the ones that are the most concerning when they enter into the human population. But as we also are beginning to study those emerging infectious diseases, that same knowledge and those same technologies are also being used in order to be able to create those same types of diseases that are recombinations of existing diseases, or also the sort of newly created functions within biological organisms. And those pose new types of complex risks that can be deliberately misused or lead to new types of accidents and unintended consequences.
Right.
And so we're getting better at often the things we know about, but it's really the things that we have not anticipated, that we might not know about, that we're studying today, that poses some of the most complex...
The bigger risks.
Complex risks.
I would agree. I would put a small caveat in. I would say, yes, we are better at detecting things in nature that we recognize as potential threats. What we're not so good about doing is gauging the likelihood that these things will actually enter into a host population that we care about, ourselves, humans, or animals, or plants, or some other aspect of the environment, and actually cause harm and spread. It's predicting the occurrence of disease and spread of disease that we're not so good about. Then when you put into the mix the possibility that humans will begin to operate in this space as deliberate actors, I think anticipation becomes even more difficult. And this is the bane of all of those who have to think about that whole other class of problem and what it might look like and how you would know that it was about to happen.
Right. So let's talk a minute about detection and diagnostics and then how we react. I want to separate those two out. Maybe we'll talk about some historic examples in the second category. Would more resources affect our ability to detect in a better way? Is this a public policy issue, or would it really not matter?
I would say to some degree it would help. It always helps.
Right.
Some
more money always helps.
More money
right.
is always a good thing. But I'll be quite frank in saying, what we also need, maybe even more so, is a coordinated strategy for thinking about the different kinds of information that must all be brought together in order to understand that detection signal.
Interesting.
Because if the public
health
system,
it's a big data problem as well.
Yeah, exactly. And when you don't have good measurements of outcomes with which to link to the environmental detection, you don't have a way of gauging, did this matter? Will this matter?
Right.
Or is it just true and unrelated?
So let's talk a little bit about how we as a country respond and how we as a global community have responded in the past. Ebola is a word people got to know from a few years ago. What's your assessment of how we as a country did and how we as an international community did in response to that crisis? Either one. Megan?
I think in many cases, the early stages of Ebola surprised many people. And a lot of that response and the problems of how to coordinate these responses are what plagued a lot of that early spread, as well as the sort of misunderstanding of what were the contributing forces, what are the cultural customs that might have led to the acceleration of that disease.
So you need an anthropologist to be involved.
Oh, very much.
Okay.
I think this is
That's
a perfect example of really how there's many different disciplines, many different types of expertise, and frankly, just the management capacity of how to make quick decisions with uncertain information that's really going to be important in being able to respond. And I think it is also coupled to why it's so important to also prevent as much as possible the emergence of these situations, because once they've already gotten started, it's very difficult to contain them. And especially when, you know, many of the places where these types of threats may emerge are places where, you know, the management of crises is the most difficult. And they can spread very quickly, especially, again, in our modern society when we are so interconnected. And so a threat elsewhere is still a threat here.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I think, generally speaking, we've usually been not so great at the start. We're slow to get started. Once we get mobilized, once we understand what the nature of the problem is, once we've understood it a bit and we have developed our resolve, then we're pretty good. And then it really comes down to how fast does this thing move? How fast will it evolve and will we keep up? It keeps reminding me that a very famous, wise Stanford geneticist and Nobel laureate, Josh Lederberg, used to say, and I love this saying, it's their genes versus our wits. They evolve far quicker than we do.
Uh-huh.
The only thing we have going for us is our noggins.
Uh-huh.
And if we don't use them and use them quickly and organize ourselves, then we're going to be behind the eight ball every time.
And we lose. Well, let's shift just for a few minutes to talk about man-made, conscious, designed uses of bioweapons. Just generally, I mean, help listeners understand to what extent we should be worried about that. Obviously, we have international treaties and regimes that allegedly prevent this from happening. We've seen from time to time that obviously is not true. And in Syria, most tragically, we've seen that. What's your assessment of the state of the man-made threats in this domain? Are there rogue states, rogue entities, rogue non-governmental organizations out there? Maybe they're not rogue. Maybe they're big nation states that are developing these weapons, even though, you know, at least I remember I was in the government during the Syrian tragedies. And obviously, there's a canon of international law that should prevent this. But what's really going on in the world? How worried should we be?
I think we should be worried, hopefully in constructive ways.
Okay, that's always good. I like
and
that.
I think we do know that there is a history of large nation states considering and actively developing biological weapons, and we know that small groups have also tried to develop biological weapons, and even more recently, sort of publicly considered their use.
Is that
and
right?
So I think there is, you know, reason to be actively vigilant against this potential misuse of biotechnology. And I think that because of advances in science and technology, the nature of the types of agents as well as the types of strategies that may be used differs. And so the calculus that was used before may not remain the same today.
Mm-hmm.
And really confronting those assumptions is very critical at this stage. And because, as you said, the Biological Weapons Convention exists, it's strong norm against the
right.
development of biological weapons. But today, that's a very sort of fragile, in some way, norm. At the same time, it is strong, because it is not verified, and so we exist in this state of trust. And so there's complex signaling on the commitments to biological security that are being made by states, being made by individuals. And so we need to work continuously on being able to make sure that signaling is strong.
We're living right in the midst of a revolution in the life sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are two bylines. One, immense capabilities now that are growing in ways we couldn't imagine. And they're being harnessed almost entirely for the good. You just can't fault this byline.
Right.
The other byline is the empowerment of the individual increasingly. And now you're thinking about, maybe everyone know what a Venn diagram is? Well, you got one circle, which is the world of those who are capable, increasingly capable. And the other circle would be the circle of those who perhaps intend to do harm. And we could argue about whether those overlap today, but I don't think we can argue about the growing size of the first and the significant size of the second and the likelihood that these will overlap increasingly as days go by.
Well, that sounds scary, but that's why I'm glad to know that both of you have combined your forces to launch the Biosecurity Initiative here at Stanford to develop responsible policies for biosecurity. Tell us a little bit about what the research and public policy aims of this initiative are.
Well, the biosecurity initiative was launched last year after really a series of discussions over not just the last few years, but really over decades on the importance of this topic. Mm-hmm. And it's involved now more than two dozen faculty across campus who have said that, you know, especially as Stanford is advancing the frontier of biological sciences and technology and a number of other areas that are part of biosecurity, that we have an opportunity, but also an obligation to safeguard the technologies that may also provide strategies to counter biological threats.
Interesting.
And so, like many of the other activities at the Freeman-Spogli Institute, we have a sort of three-part strategy of advancing research. And this is really research across all of the schools at the university.
Right.
As we said, it's a really
interdisciplinary
challenge.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
As well as fundamentally in education, right? Educating both on the side of policymakers, future policymakers that might be confronting these threats, as well as, you know, scientists and engineers that may be contributing to mitigating these threats or could potentially contribute to causing them. And then really on policy engagement. And policy engagement today, I think we recognize it really isn't just at the level of policymakers in Washington.
Right.
It's the type of research practices and industrial practices, right, that are shaping this landscape. And so we have a number of different projects that we've put forward. I work mostly with international communities of life scientists and engineers,
right,
on how they consider the risks of their work and their responsibilities for mitigating biological threats. But we have a number of other colleagues that also intersect with other parts of this challenge in Centers for Global Health here, over in bioengineering, in the School of Medicine with David and others. And so there's a number of different people and activities we're pursuing.
I don't think there's a better suited university on this planet to take on this kind of complex problem. I mean, you've heard that the kinds of disciplines that we need involved, the kinds of expertise, kinds of experience, they're all here. And there is immense latent interest. People don't even know that they're interested until mm-hmm. you start talking about this and they go, crap, I want to get involved here. Tell me what I can do.
Well, you both work on some very scary issues with no obvious concrete solutions, but I am excited that you're actually trying to solve them through this new initiative. So, and I'm excited that you take the educational part seriously and for spending some time with us today here on World Class. So Megan and David, thanks for being here. We'll call you back from time to time to check in and to see how the initiative's going.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Really good to be here.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman-Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.